Welcome to the bridge, Greg.
Oh, thank you very much, Kira. Pleasure to be on with you today.
So I decided that we would do something a little different, and I wanted to talk about storytelling with you, and I'm not really sure why, but we're going to go ahead and have a conversation and see where it leads. And if it leads us elsewhere into other subjects, I'm fine with that too.
Okay, sounds good. I don't know why you chose me either, but if you're guided, that's good enough for me.
Okay, good. So I was thinking about the role of the storyteller in tribal culture as the conveyor of culture-shaping lessons, hardships, victories. They carry lessons across generational lines. Both women and men are respected storytellers in Native tradition. And I was thinking about all my friends in the UK and what the storytelling tradition is over there, and I thought about bards. And so I was thinking of how storytellers can be both the ones who are upholding the status quo and the ones who are fighting the insurgency. And so I wanted to look at Native storytellers and bards and sort of pick that apart, because bards really became a tool of empire. And maybe that's the case now, too, in America. So what do you think about that as a start?
Well, I think the one point that jumps out of that straight away for me is that the use of stories to withhold the status quo, because, as you mentioned, in indigenous societies, the stories were a way of the culture being passed on, and important aspects of, you know, whether these were real events in the past or whether they were entirely mythical, they all had basically lessons in them. And you can see how so-called official narratives are very much used to preserve the status quo, and probably have been for a very long time, so since the advent of empire. But I think that it's that old phrase, you know, the stories we tell ourselves. And I think sometimes we adopt, just as you would have done in, you know, passing down culture, we adopt stories that are not our own, but which then shape our, you know, our outlook, our psyche, and our entire lives. So I think that as technology and society has become more sophisticated, or perhaps we should say complex, these storytelling sort of devices and methods have definitely been adapted as tools of conditioning and control.
I'm glad that you said you made that distinction, because one of the things I also wanted to do in this conversation is actively suspend belief in linear progression. So our brains are taught to think in terms of linear progression, and so every time we start going down that road, I want us to catch ourselves, just like you did there with perhaps it's not exactly the right word to choose, and to choose another one that might make more sense when suspending that belief in linear progression. Because I think when we look at indigenous stories, we sense a knowledge or a knowing that maybe we may have lost and can possibly regain somehow.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element of that. This is why these stories resonate with us. And I can't remember, but I think some movie director or something, or certainly the point has been made that there are only, I can't remember what the number is, but a very small number of actual stories, and they just get recast and, you know, with different characters and slightly different events and what have you. And there's definitely a resonance with these stories. I mean, a good example in popular culture is Star Wars, you know, which is just, you know, the evil lord and the alluring princess and the hero and all of the elements that you would have in, you know, a typical fairy tale, if we think of a, you know, we perhaps read when we grew up, right there, that's just Star Wars, just in a different setting. And those sort of archetypes and the familiar patterns resonate with us, and that, I think that's what you're getting at with, like, an indigenous story, that we can, it speaks to us in a way that is almost beyond the, you know, the exact details of the tale itself. I think that's what these devices are for. I think we can devalue that a lot in our treatment of these devices in popular culture. I mean, for example, a lot of these devices are now used to sell us stuff, you know, in advertising. And that's an adaptation of it, but it's not, it, for me anyway, it kind of devalues, you know, what these things that we, and how these methods by which we interact with each other, it devalues them.
So the use of archetypes, when you're picking apart these modern adaptations of age-old stories, sometimes, I'm trying to get at what you're saying, we can devalue its use in commercialization, but miss the larger point of the story, or the larger point of the use of archetypes?
Well, both, really, depending on the case in point, if you see what I mean. It could be either.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, Star Wars, I remember watching it in third grade, in fact, and thinking there was a lot more to it than I was getting at the time. I had all...
Yeah, Trump, that's kind of interesting in itself, because George Lucas is just not the most sophisticated storyteller in the world, and he just lays it on with a trowel, you know, but there's probably stuff in there that he's not aware of.
Right, subconscious, because the archetypes go that deep, that almost anyone who had a budget could make a movie, and there would be something in that, you know, for someone, a message in that.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
So I wonder if that might be the same for the old storytellers as well, that there's a method of telling a story where there's a lesson for each, not only each generation, but on an individual level, there's a broad enough tale where people can bring themselves into that story. And it might not be the intended, just like art, it might not be the intended message, but what someone gets from it, it's still valid, or it's still meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. And we insert ourselves into stories as well, don't we? I think that's what you're getting out there with that. Whether it's watching a film and you identify with a particular character, or you recognize someone you know in a particular character, or whether it's inserting yourselves into these myths and legends that have been handed down since time immemorial.
And I think the way of telling a story, an audio story, like not a movie, but something where like when you're reading, you have to picture it in your own head, what's going on. So there's something about that process that I think that we're losing, because we're becoming so visually oriented with movies and TV and things like that. That I've realized since we've got rid of TV that it doesn't take long. I'm an audio-oriented person, but it doesn't take long to regain that ability, or to heighten that ability, to be able to... I worry about our children who are, you know, they're shown movies to teach them things, and they're really not that much into reading, you know. So I think that there's an element of inserting yourself in the story in a way that doesn't happen for people visually. I don't know, what do you
think? Yeah, and our attention spans as well have become affected. I'll say our, maybe not so much you and I, our generation, but certainly with younger people. I'm sounding like a real cliche now, I'm sounding like an old duffer or some sort of Luddite, but I do see it with, you know, young people, many of them, not all of them, you know, but this is just observing, you know, I don't have any kids myself, but observing other young people, their almost total inability to be still or to focus on anything for any length of time. God forbid they'd be asked to take part in some activity that was just purely oral. I remember when I was young, you know, one of the adults would read you a story at bedtime, and it was just so exciting. That's how I seem to remember it, depending on the story, of course, you know, but it was so exciting, like sort of what happens next. And I don't know if parents read kids' stories at bedtime. I guess they do, but certainly when kids get older and you know, they're ever earlier, they're interacting with technology, you know, typically their phones, but other devices as well. And yes, stories are still and always will be used to convey information, including for purposes of education. But I do think you're absolutely right. Something is being lost, and anybody who listens to my podcast will know that I'm not entirely sure a couple hundred years from now there's going to be an internet, and I don't know what else there might be, what else you might lose in terms of technology. So I'm glad to hear you sort of express the feeling that this is something that we can get back, you know, because it is innate in us, because I think that's something that we will need in the future.
Yeah, and so your suspension in linear progression is pretty solid as well. That perhaps
it's such it really is a. I mean, I don't think time actually exists. I think it's just a device that we've come up with. But the linear progression thing is so dominant. You're absolutely right.
And I think it's a tool of empire. I think it's probably one of the biggest tools of empire that there is, because everything, every innate understanding that we have that, this doesn't seem right, this is wrong, well, it's all going to get fixed in time because humanity is progressing throughout time. So you don't need to worry about it or fix it or address it or really even fully understand it, because it'll work itself out because we're progressing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the I know that you're a reader and or listener to John Michael Greer. If people look at some of his writing, that's if they can focus long enough to read more than a page, they'll very strongly get the impression that that is indeed an official narrative that maintains the status quo and keeps us looking forward, as you say, for everything to become all right, or looking back on what was good, you know, in our lives, and never in the only thing that exists, which is right now. In fact, I had a professor on, and I can't remember how the hell he came around to it, but at some point during our interview, he said, so there is no past, there is no future. He says, I've got something to tell you. There is no present moment. And I'll have to go back and listen to it, because it was just so mind-bending that I've forgotten what he said.
Yeah, because, I mean, I've come to think that the present moment is really all we have in terms of our power, because you can't, you know, you can't change the past, and the future is what it's going to be. And you can only change the future in the present moment, so the decision that you make right now can be the only thing that would affect the future, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and progress is the big story of the future, isn't it, really? That's the story that we're told, and I said earlier that we tell ourselves, but we take it on board. And it's, again, stories are powerful in the sense that we can see sometimes if they diverge from reality, that for some people, that doesn't actually matter. Reality will have to go in the bin then, because we've got this story and we're sticking to it.
Right. When the veneer begins to crack and reality shows through, well, then you plaster it back over with the illusion that it's all going to be better in the future. And I think one of the biggest ways that this is revealed, I think, right now in America, is the evaporation of the middle class. All those people who were middle class are still pretending that they are middle class. And you see it with hatred of the poor, who the really, really struggling poor, instead of the former middle class poor. And you see it with, you know, the people just pretending that they're really, that at some point, this is just a phase we're going through, and we'll go back to the way that we used to prosper before. This is just a phase, and it's Obama's fault, or whatever the narrative happens to be for any particular group. There really is no large-scale, I don't know if it's understanding, but recognition that we're not going back. We're never going back. It's not going to be the same, ever. And perhaps I have a unique vantage point in that I think I'm probably the first, I don't know, generation for it to be almost impossible for me to do better than my parents. Whereas my parents, you know, they did better than their parents because they went to school, they did well, and then they got a good job afterward. I did the same exact thing, didn't turn out so well for me, you know, because it can't. You know, that possibility for me is gone, and it's gone for everyone else after me too. And
very much so. And you know, that's, as you say, a good example of the narrative not fitting with reality. But again, it's the past is used to reinforce the stories about the future as well, because we know in terms of maintaining status quo, the nuggets of the past are selectively gathered Some things are shoved off under the carpet, other things are buffed up to look a little bit better than they actually were. And then those elements are used to construct the story of the future, as it were. And of course, the future never gets here. That's one of the things about it. You know, it's always just right now. So placing our hopes out there, I suppose it's something that there have been periods of, however you want to define progress, in the past, you know, material progress or in terms of gaining knowledge. Certainly people who lived through the Renaissance may have felt that humanity was the up and up, on the up and up, and we know that a lot of Victorians, the pioneering scientists and what have you, certainly saw history as a one-way trip. So I think just in terms of, you know, a big sort of meta story that's not working anymore, as you say, I think we're the first generation to really come into that, you know, we're going to need some new stories for going forward, you know, but they'll develop in their own time, I guess. It's just a question of if anybody was listening to this conversation 50 years from now, whether they would recognize what we were engaged in as anything comparable to what they were doing, or, you know, they at their particular time in history.
Right. I mean, when you were saying about the nuggets of the past, I think one of the... 'cause my grandparents were from the generation that went through the Depression. And so the Depression is this sort of epic... In our minds, it's this epic time where it was so hard and people were starving and, you know, and everybody knew about it. It was acknowledged. It was going on. And there were... the government did everything they could to fix it and blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, what is a jobless recovery but a depression? If there aren't any jobs, how is it a recovery? Because rich people are still rich? I mean, I think we're in a depression now, but we don't want to admit it to ourselves. We don't, it's too painful, or, you know, we're still fooled enough by the illusion to not know. I mean, I don't know.
It's interesting mentioning the Depression, really, because if you think about how stories were told then, and obviously you'd had printing around for a number of centuries, but, you know, and most people, I'm guessing, in most parts of the world could read, but there still would have been, and you had radio, but there still would have been a lot of oral communication, information passed on that way. I mean, again, not only did I have stories read to me when I was a child, but I can remember when I was too young to be able to sort of, you know, to be allowed to stay up in the evening when the adults were all still up, you know, I had to go to bed early. It wasn't unusual for, you know, a group of adults to be in the, you know, the drawing room, living room, whatever you want to call it. Television, if there was one, turned off, and they just talked for the evening. And that's something which, you know, I enjoy to this day, but I don't see a lot of that going on when I look at the blue glows, you know, from all the windows, you know, the television, and people grouped around that instead. And my point here, I guess, is that the information that was disseminated about our predicament during the things like a depression, we're now living in an era of stories everywhere and the ability to disseminate information. We're surrounded by it. If anything, we've got an overload of it. And yet, you know, we have this reluctance to give up on the myth of progress, despite the evidence staring at us. And then all those years ago, you would have thought it would have been much easier maybe for the government to sort of, you know, pull the wool over people's eyes and put out a few statistics and things that showed things differently. But then that generation, many of them who were, you know, older at that time, it's not that maybe it didn't take them by surprise, but there had been hardship before. You know, a lot of the comforts that we live with today, one of which is the expectation of nothing ever going wrong. You know, nothing big can happen to affect us. That's just the myth that we live under. You know, that in itself is very ingrained now. And that's decades. You know, we've got a couple of generations now labouring under that misapprehension. And certainly the thing you referred to a few moments ago, my parents' generation, when I talk to people of that age, generally speaking, as you say, not possible for me to do better than them, but they have a lot of cognitive dissonance when I explain the situation. I say, like, I don't have a house that's paid off. I don't have two cars. I don't go on three or four holidays a year. I don't have a pension plan. I mean, my grandfather, for heaven's sake, he stopped work when he was 55 because he could afford to. You see what I mean? So generally what we're laboring under now is this misapprehension that nothing can ever go wrong, and yet there's never been more information available to us.
Yeah, it's a weird juxtaposition. I've never had a vacation, ever, and I'm 46 years old, ever.
Mm.
I mean, when I was a kid, maybe, with my family, but my entire adult life, I've never been able to have a vacation. I've never been able to afford one. The way that I got over to the UK, England, Ireland, Scotland, was as a student. I figured out a way to get myself over there and travel as a student. But otherwise, it's just not possible.
It depends what you call vacation. I mean, I'm fortunate in that I like the country I live in, so if I want to take time off, I'm quite happy to do it on a very minimal budget, and just travel a couple of hundred miles up the road, so to speak. I'm not very demanding. I'm not one for going to Spain and lying on the beach or doing expensive, action adventure holidays. I don't know, counting wolves in Greenland or something like that. Just anything that can add up to a lot of travel and a lot of other expense. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of that regular thing of, take X number of weeks off. But again, that whole structure, of getting your holiday, your block, where the cliche, certainly in Britain, was that everyone would leave and go to a hot country. That's part of a structure which is going away too, which is the get a job at 18, retire at 60 or whatever, and maybe work for two or three companies, that's going away. And with it, all the other attendant stuff kind of dangling off it.
Right, yeah, it's gone. And, as far as taking lavish vacations or anything, I would, I'd be happy to go to Florida or something like that. But the work structure, as you say, is part of it too. You don't really get vacation time. Paid vacation is a luxury now. It's not something that people, not everyone gets. People who are fortunate enough to be working, because the jobs are all service jobs now. And you don't get paid vacation with service jobs. So it's either the government or Walmart or a service job. Those are the only choices, especially in rural areas of America.
And where's that going anyway? If you see what I mean, if we want to make up a new story,
right?
It always occurred to me that the old cliche was, oh, maybe you could get a job flipping burgers. Well, unless you're going to be in a whole country of people all doing service jobs, all serving each other, which doesn't add up. Now, of course, it's never that extreme, but if the economy is weighted too much in that direction, I mean, for example, look how little manufacturing goes on in former powerhouses like the US and the UK now. I mean, I said to somebody the other week, you just try buying a British television and see how far you get, So that sort of, and it's an attempt, I guess, to maintain the illusion of progress, that big narrative,